You are listening to 4ED Forages. It's a pleasure to have New Age icon Laraji in conversation with Helado Negro for today's episode. A lot of laughter and even bubbles coming up.
How's it going, Laraji?
Perfect and whole, flowing. I'm very optimistic. The whole cosmos is on time, on track.
That's pretty cool. I dig that. Where are you at?
Pardon?
Where are you at right now?
I'm at Harlem.
Besides Earth.
I'm at Harlem.
Oh, you're at Harlem.
And it's about going on about one twenty-two. Yes.
Cool.
Yep. And where you be?
I be in Asheville today. I live in Asheville, North Carolina.
How about that?
Yeah. You been here?
I've been there once or twice. Yes, and I enjoyed it. There was something called the something of light up in the mountains. A temple of light or a light center. That's what it's called, the light center.
And, I got to look it up. I don't know it.
Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a Sufi dance organization there that I attended, a Sufi gathering. But it was a pleasant town to visit.
Yeah, I dig it so far. We just moved here from New York. We left in July of last year.
Oh, really?
And it was a much needed break from just a new chapter in life, more than anything.
Well, Asheville's an interesting place to choose. You drove there?
Yeah, that was an intense moment. But some things that I've learned about Asheville that are pretty cool. It's a temperate rainforest. It's a power vortex, and it's just real cool. People are real sweet.
Yeah. Have you driven up and around the mountains there?
We have. Yeah, we've gotten an opportunity to go on a few hikes, like check out. There's a ton of waterfalls out here too. So that's
That's a real shift.
New experience for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't you miss the quiet of New York?
I do. I do miss that quiet. It's a special kind of quiet, you know? It's a really unique quiet there for sure. I think here it's just different space and place in my mind. And I've never really lived somewhere like here before. So I think it's new and sweet in some respects, but it's also just acclimating to just the change more than anything. And I think as much as New York is like New York, Asheville's Asheville, you know?
When I was there, I visited with a friend, stayed with some friends who lived there. I met them at a conference in Pennsylvania. And so I stayed with them and I was able to just freely walk around Asheville. And then one particular evening, I discovered that the Sufi order there was having a Dances of Universal Peace, I think that was called, in one of the large spaces there. And these people with whom I was staying loaned me their van so I could drive to Winston-Salem, I think it was, to visit another friend. And I remember driving, it was like going downhill all the way from Asheville into the other part of North Carolina. Another experience I had with being up in the mountains there, that it's a good thing to be totally sober and straight to drive those mountains. Whoa. Yeah.
The Blue Ridge Parkway. It's beautiful. It's amazing. But yeah, it's kind of no joke. It's like two-way traffic. There's no lights at night. You definitely want to not be be under any kind of other influence other than normal influence, I guess.
And the light center up there is supposed somewhere in the 60s or 70s, a man, a visionary, created this center, light center, and I guess it's like a holistic spiritual meditation yoga friendly kind of a situation. I don't know if it's still operating there or if the people who ran it ran their course on the earth plane and the place has been converted to something else.
It looks like it's still there. I'm looking it up right now. It's called it's in Black Mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks cool.
Black Mountain really cool. Is connected to Asheville.
It's not far. Yeah, I think it's like a 35-minute drive outside of town.
We call it either New Agey or hippie or advanced progressive settled down hippie.
But it's like here there's deep roots with a lot of folks who've came here seeking something out alternative to like other living styles. It sounded like, from what I understand, before I moved here, a friend of mine, drummer, he's one of the drummers in Tortoise. He was born and raised in Asheville, and I think his family moved here as part of a commune in like the early 60s.
A commune in that area?
Yeah, I think it was a pretty common thing for folks to be getting land out here in a commune sort while, I don't know, it seemed cool. I mean, in that respect, it seemed cool in my perspective right now.
Are you working with the land in any way? Growing your own little garden or hugging a tree?
I'm like the opposite of I had like really deep experiences with nature for like the first time during the lockdown, during the pandemic. I was living in Marfa for 6 months.
Living where?
And in Marfa, Texas.
Martha.
Marfa.
Yes. You're saying Martha.
No, Marfa with an F.
You in Texas?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We were living there for 6 months, yeah. So I had really interesting connections with nature there for the first time. I grew up in Florida, in South Florida, and nature there is different. It's dense like any like sprawling city like L.A. or Atlanta, but you're surrounded by nature, but it doesn't have the same kind of interaction. You know, I go to the beach every day growing up, but it was just different. And then living in cities, you know, living in New York or living in Atlanta, or I used to live in Savannah for a long time, too.
You got around different. A bit.
Yeah. I dig it. You too, though. Were you born and raised in Harlem?
Well, I'm kind of disappoint you, but I was never born.
Well, I'm not disappointed about that. But where did you grow up?
The body took form in Hahnemann Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Yes. And then the family moved from there after 2 years living there, moved to Perth Amboy, New Jersey.
Okay.
And that's across the river from Staten Island. And Perth Amboy is a very mixed ethnic, religious community. They got along pretty well. And so my exposure to harmony, inter-ethnic harmony, I learned it, I lived it.
That's awesome. And I actually had watched that interview you did with, is it Larry Mizell's son?
Larry Mizell, yes.
With his son, and he, just kind of hearing like all these cool stories that maybe a lot of folks didn't know about, like your different histories. And like, I mean, like you're knowing about where you studied at Howard, but then like folks you connected with, like Larry, and then like kind of part of your like background, your musical background.
Yeah.
Just the diverse places your musical background is like traversed. I think that was like eye-opening for me. I was like, damn, because I'm, I love so much of your work, and I think I've like listened to it in so many different times of my life. But then like hearing that, I was like, oh shit, like I never made that connection, and it made a bridge for me where I was like, I know the Mizell brothers, like what they've done, and then it's just cool to make that connection with you and them.
It's Larry Mizell and his brother Fonce Mizell and a Freddie Perrin. We were members of the same fraternity at Howard. And they went out to California after college and got into the music business very, very big time, but I stayed on the East Coast. I was a little too hesitant to go out west yet. But Larry and I got to write a bunch of music together when he was still living on the East Coast. And he took that with him when he moved out west, and some of it got produced on Marvin Gaye, on Donald Byrd and the Blackbirds, and a couple of other people. And that kept our connection going. I get to see him occasionally when I'm visiting out on the West Coast.
I like that. I feel like that's such a rare, I don't know, I guess it's a rare thing to have friends for so long, and also a rare thing to have a connection through music with friends for so long. I think a lot of folks maybe, people who enter into making music or art have phases and stages, but maybe there's disconnects along the way. But I think it's special. And I think it was really heartwarming to like hear that, because I do feel like I have connections like that with certain friends, and I hope that it continues.
Well, there's something about, you probably understand this as an artist, as a musician, that in your work, in our work, we assume a very intimate connection to the faceless audience, let's say. And then when we see somebody or see the audience, there's no connecting, because the connection has already been made. And through the sound, through our music. And so through our art, we can meet those with whom we've had a long time connection on the abstract world, the timeless connection. And it can just spontaneously express through a spontaneous meeting, a flash relationship, a flash meeting, a flash community, just spontaneously. In the presence of someone, we can feel a timeless connection. So that through our art, I feel that we are connecting to a timeless community, a timeless audience, a timeless following, a timeless family. And when you say it's nice to make these long connections on this physical plane, yes, it is. And I'm also saying that there are connections we're making with our art on an even longer timelessness, and that meeting the right conscious members of our audience, we may have a spontaneous deep drop in to this sense of we have an unlimited connection here, that we're caught up in each other's eternity. And I feel that in our music, in our sounds, we are using nonverbal language, even behind the words. The nonverbal language of sound allows us to remember beyond this particular personal history, this personal location, this personal identity. So that even though we're making music for the ambient family, or making music for the pop, or for the new feeling community, whatever we are focused on, underneath of that, the sound behind our words are connecting us to a timeless family that is beyond just this century. Even though some of the instruments we use are special to this particular time, still the intention that we as artists project through the way we use sound bring us back into the family that has no century. It's beyond ethnic, it's beyond this particular century. And so you can be sitting in a park one day and someone can come up to you and says, I like your music. And in that moment there, you're feeling, hey, this is not a stranger. We have something timeless and common here. We have a timeless relationship somehow. And in this flash moment, whether it's 5 minutes or 20 seconds that you interact with this person, you experience a timeless connection. And I think this is very fulfilling to our soul to feel the family, to feel that behind this world of othernesses and local countries and local ethnic groups, there is this timeless familyhood that we can feel it. It's invisible, yet we feel it. And it expresses itself through our art, whether we're conscious of it or not. And I feel every artist that I've heard who does music, even if they're not conscious of it, I hear in their sound a reaching into our eternalhood, our oneness, the self that comes alive by the power of sound and motion. The power of sound and motion. And I hear in your works, I hear good lots of motion. First, the wild conversation, the wind conversation. I like what's going on in the background there.
That song was inspired by what we were just talking about nature, me connecting in Marfa, and a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I was with my partner, Christy, and we were laying down under a tree in this field. And it's kind of a field, meaning in the desert, but there's a patch of grass in this park. And we had had lunch, and for some reason that moment began to permeate for a long time. It was like a ripple that kind of just didn't stop. And when I started to play those chords on a guitar later, I just couldn't stop thinking about that moment. And it really, that's what the song is about. It's kind of this immense gratitude for like being alive and under a tree and some shade, but then also kind of despair in kind of knowing that it's not always like this, I guess. It's kind of like a two-sided feeling.
You know, what you just said reminded me that when I was in Marfa with my dear friend, Arch Yosiananda, it must have been 3 or 4 years ago. And during one of the evenings there, wind happened in such an intensity that we had to go take our performance indoors. And on the day before that even, we tried to do an outdoor concert. And the wind got so interesting, it was blowing our instruments around. So when you brought up the question of wind and relates it to Marfa, I can relate to the wind. I don't know if that was extraordinary or is something that's common to Marfa. Interesting wind accelerations.
Yeah, I think it's both, honestly. I think it is extraordinary and I think it is common, but I think it's special because it's such a unique place, and it maybe is a unique convergence of like environment and feeling. One of the really wild things that we experienced while we were there, I don't know if you experienced this where you were during the lockdown, but there was a moment that summer in 2020, late or midsummer, where there was this dust storm that was making its way from Africa across the ocean into where we were in Texas, you know? And it was kind of this phenomenal thing, this thought of just like the wind was carrying all this dust from the desert in Africa and just coming over and dropping dust all throughout this other desert in North America. So I don't know. That's my wind conversation.
Yeah. Great. There must be a song like you. These are lovely titles here.
I appreciate you asking.
Did you say this? Saying this to the President of the United States?
I like what you just said just now. Earlier, you were talking about the New Feeling community. And I like that idea of the New Feeling community. And I think that's what that song is about, that there must be a song like you. Like, what is this song? Are you the song, or is this feeling a song? Or it's like me, like, questioning everything or seeing everything, like looking at a tree or looking at a person and like being like, well, there's got to be a song like you, you know? Can we flip it back a little bit, Laraji? Can we?
Yes.
Do you remember when we met that time in 2018 at the airport?
I'm not remembering it. Did you say it was Berlin?
Yeah. So I could give you it was Berlin. It must have been August of 2018. And I think you were you were having a layover in Berlin, and you said you were on your way to recording some pianos somewhere, or you had just gone to record piano somewhere.
Wow, let me think.
Or you were just going to, you were going to go visit a piano maybe. I'm not sure.
That's most interesting. And you approached me in the Berlin airport.
Yeah, I saw you there and I said, I'm very apprehensive about bothering people in airports, because I feel like there's like airports are so unfortunately like high stress. I think everyone's kind of a little like wound up, and I just hate. But I mean, I personally feel like it's like the one place I need to just try to just focus on not being stressed out about something. I guess travel, but I just couldn't resist saying hi. And and then we talked about what we were up to. And I guess I'm like remembering wrong exactly what you had said, but I remember you had mentioned something about wanting to go visit a piano or play a piano somewhere. And then I was sharing with what you had said to me, I mean, what we had been up to in Berlin. And I shared the story, and, you know, we emailed about this too, but just when you had said the expression "far in," it tripped me out, and I was like, it just became like imprinted on my hippocampus. You know, I was just stuck with it.
Yeah, it's for me, far in is like going into safe territory, going inward, immersing yourself in yourself, knowing yourself, befriending yourself, hanging out or hanging in with yourself, going far in. When I think of the New Age, is about diving inwardly, whether through contemplation, meditation, nature, Tai Chi, Chuan, just sitting, and coming in as far in as we can until we're there. And so far in, as opposed to far out, is an automatic response. And it's interesting to me to watch the resistance I have to switching my language around, flipping around. And far in. And there are a couple of other terms I like that require to be mindful in my speech and as opposed to being automatic and mechanical. It's in mechanical say, hey, man, that's far out. And to actually intervene in the mechanical impulse there, say, that's far in, which is a comical shift to those who are used to hearing far out. It's a playful and it's meaningful. And the idea that you should have put those words on the cover of your album, that's far in. That's supporting the inward mobility, pointing inward.
I was just happy when we were communicating about it that you were down with it. And I'm just, everything you just said was a lot of what I've been thinking about. I think what I've meditated on just... I know, I wish I would have heard all of what you just said before as well. I think it would have, I'm grateful to hear it now too, because I think it really resonates way more than it ever has before in my life to intervene with the automatic.
Well, how much of where you are right now is contributing to your continuing to do music? Are you doing music there?
Yeah. Asheville. What's
do
that?
I see a hi-hat in the background.
Yeah. There's a hi-hat under my armpit.
Your temple is up and running.
It is. It's a special space for sure. I have this, check this out. I have this moving desk. It's a pretty groovy thing, you know?
Yeah. If you know, if you ever did a podcast, that's how you would open. And here's Roberto.
Yeah, it's been good here. It's been great. It is so different. Like, you know, I think in New York, you have two options. You have the option to be a hermit or be involved with what's going on outside. And I think here you're provided with one option, and the other option you have to like aggressively work towards. So I think that's like the big difference, where it's like the option being like, it's easy to kind of just be in a quieter, less like social space and place here. It's kind of just what comes with the territory. But to socialize or to have a lot of people around you, you have to really like seek it out in these parts. And so it's a different way of life, but it's nice. But we're also about to go on tour, so there's like that. When you're on, I feel like when you're on tour, you're kind of like in this hyper state of like socializing, where there's like so many people around you, so many people talking to you, so many people interacting, and so much like feedback with audience and performance. So I'm making a lot, which is really fun. I just like to make things every day. And that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, and like kind of flipping it back. I have to lower the desk back down.
How to turn these Zoom sessions into real humor. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you?
So you're sitting on the desk too?
No, I'm sitting on a chair.
Oh, what's rising up then? Oh, the camera is sitting on the desk.
Exactly. I see. What's,
the desk is moving. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
I was talking to a friend of mine, and her and I were talking about this idea of like, you know, she makes a lot of different kind of music. She makes music, and then she has bands, and then she makes music, solo music, and then she puts out music whenever she wants, right? And she was talking about something new that she released, and I really loved it. And she was like, yeah, she's like, I felt like it was like an outlier. It was something that I'm not really necessarily pursuing. It's just another song that I made. And she was just talking about how she like manages these expectations, because sometimes people feel like, or she's had experiences where people were like, oh my God, you're abandoning your instrument. Now you're making this. And she's like, oh no, it's just something that I'm making. And then when I make this, I make that. And then, or I make this, that's what I make. But I'm never, it's not like one thing is prescribed for me. It's just I'm making what I make. And I guess what I'm thinking about with your work, when I think about your work, I think about like all these, like the things you're making now, and then the things that have been like re-released in your life that people are being exposed to. And I like what you were talking about, this eternalness to this connection to like music and people, and how there's, when you make it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's just connected to the consciousness of now or people's consciousness of now, but how do you struggle with like connecting with releases that are old and connecting with releases that are new, in terms of like the work that you're making now and the work that you had made then?
I hear what you're saying, and there's just a smidgen of hesitation of saying, why should I release that when I'm doing this? And another area says, well, it may be good for whoever is interested to see a progression, to see the early, even if, like on some of my earlier works, I might have used words that don't quite fit into my present sense of truth and philosophy. But I'd say to have who's ever interested in early music and to tune into the current music, that's allows them to see a growth or a change or an evolution there. I have also noticed that there's some resistance in maybe some producers of leaning into my newer music and favoring the earlier music, that there's a resistance. And it might be because some of the earlier music might be called lo-fi, or I was in more of a playful mood using a Casio keyboard at the time, that I was exploring and experimenting. I mean, I don't know, it's more freer then, but with a lower tech instrumentation, lower tech pedals and effects for many of my cassette recordings, although the studio recordings were a little higher tech. So any resistance, a conflict I have there is...
you're talking about like vision
becoming
songs.
Transparent, or just allowing yourself, I won't say be naked, to see where you've been, where you were experimenting with at 40 years ago, and where you are now. And I like exploring with new pedals, and because they allow me to reach for maybe even more subtle and abstract colors by which to paint my inner imagination out into sound. But I do listen to the earlier music more than I used to, since it's been brought up into new releases. And I'm kind of impressed with the simplicity of it then, and how I might have used one or two pedals. Sometimes I would just leaned on one pedal, like a phaser, and maybe add a reverb later. Now I've been exploring so many high-tech effects that really take me deeper into my approach is sound painting, or you call it ambient sound painting, or imagery through sound. Before it was simple and exploratory. Today it's maybe a more sophisticated electronically, but still a freedom of exploration. And also my meditative intention in the earlier years are still here in this age. So there's this underlying timelessness that I can feel when I'm listening to earlier music and then I'm feeling as I am in performance currently. But that is an interesting question. Do I feel any resistance or conflict or... just a little bit of thinking, should I quiet all of that and let people focus on where I am now? And then I says, no, that's, somebody can use that information. It's like to know that about me, about the way I expressed back then. And then to see this and see, wow, look at this. You've come to this area and you started there. I feel it's a sense of freedom that I have, I'm grateful for, that I'm not locked in, stereotyped or typecast. That's sort of dictated by the inner journey. As I open deeper and longer, then more comes up inside my earphones. Thing comes up inside the music, like one thing that starts to emerge more in my music is space, playing with space, and also the conscious awareness of what I'm doing and do it with more passion, sort of like drones and pads and sustained spaces, going into spaces that are... They're like pads, energetic sound pads, where there's a harmonic feel that's just pulsing and staying with it, even in concert, to hold something like that for a minute or two or even more as a contemplative environment. So when I look at my earlier works, I touched in on that in my earlier compositions. And as I listen to them, I see there are places that I can extend more, that I enjoy being without a destination, just being present and this feel like taking a sound bath, an ambient pad sound bath. And I appreciate doing more of that now without necessarily having to go somewhere with a concert performance to find different pools of interesting sound happenings and let the audience enjoy a sound bath. And that tendency to use sound that way has come about through my inward journey of meditation and discovering the beauty of being able to just stay and stop leaving. Just stay. Don't go somewhere. Don't do something. Just stay. And that with this attitude, this expanded attitude of staying, is showing up in my music more than it did show up in the late 70s and early 80s. The music that supports the conscious awareness in just staying, not going with the flow of conversation, not going with the flow of words or outer narratives, but staying. And it sounds like what you're saying about Asheville. Asheville allows you an expanded option of just staying, maybe with yourself, or quiet, or in a contemplative space. And maybe that's your evolution going on there, that maybe Asheville will start showing up in your musical expressions.
I hope so. I'm looking for it, for sure. You reminded me of something a friend of mine said one time, and actually it was in that time that I was in Berlin. We were having breakfast at this hotel, out, and we were outdoors, and they were playing music, and she was like, damn, why are they playing music? It's as if we're not enough. And I love that, you know, I love that thought. I was like, yeah, let's go turn this music off. I was like, we got each other right now.
Absolutely.
I love that. I feel like I'm connecting with that, with what you're saying, this idea of staying. I think I've been thinking about that a lot. The fact that we had to stay so long indoors and stay with each other. And I was lucky to be with somebody, you know, I was with my partner the whole time. And, you know, a lot of realizations, a lot of hard realizations about myself, like knowing that I was like always on the go, more so truths coming from her telling me how much I was on the go, and me, you know, releasing myself from like that denial of like being like, oh yeah, I really was. I wasn't staying in one place.
And so, how is it staying in one place? Do you feel that you're honest with yourself in answering that kind of question?
I think it's getting more real. I like real in the sense that I think in the past I was like very like hyper aware of like trying to make certain things happen, you know, on a financial level, on a like career level, on a self kind of hope level. But then I think part of me leaving New York was part of that decision to understand that like I can be somewhere else and understand this better somewhere
else. Yes, and survive.
And survive. For real. Surviving was definitely like a crucial part. So I think, yeah, the truth, I'm trying to live and be honest with myself with staying. Sometimes I kind of fool myself into being like, you're staying, but you're kind of going now, but you're staying. I think I'm, you know, sometimes I catch myself tricking myself. Yeah. I think that's what I'm trying to still release from.
Well, you can untrick yourself with your breath. If you can maybe read or go on the internet and find some breath exercises that launch you into exploring conscious, connected breathing. That's a way to bring your nervous system into a place where it cooperates with your staying. It's you can trick or untrick your nervous system with your breath, and the breath can give yourself, your whole body, permission to enjoy staying, to enjoy being here, to enjoy not having to rush and go somewhere else. Asheville sounds like a place where you'll have an optimal opportunity to be with your breath and buddy up with your breath. Usually it involves the inhalation connected to the exhalation. Breath is compact, lightweight, portable, and affordable. And any resistance to doing this is really a resistance to owning your own power to direct yourself back into the now. The breath. And some of the perks about buddying up with your breath is that your own performance, backstage prep, and even on stage, that you bring a new connection to breath through your music. And there'll be a new flow, a new openness, a new etherealness, a new groundedness, a new passion in your performance presentation, the more you're buddying up with your breath. And back to the original part of this is that it's about you bonding with yourself in Asheville, using your breath to help you to acclimate to the expanded peace opportunities there, the opportunities to stay and not be bored with being in such a unrushed environment. So I breathe through you, to you, as you, Roberto. Roberto is breathing. Oh, yes. Breathe on, Roberto. Breathe. Oh, yes. That's my Roberto breathing. Oh, Roberto. Yes. So you got the picture there, Roberto? Of course, you're always breathing or you wouldn't be here. But I found that playing with the breath, exploring the breath, it's a good musical director. Like in some of my improvisations, I wait for the exhalation to start a new phrase. And I find that when I let the breath enter into my collaborations, that a certain luminous magic happens. So I can imagine walking through Asheville forests or mountains and hanging out with my breath while I'm viewing or taking in the view or watching a bear chasing me. Oh, yes, here comes the bear. I'm breathing, bear. Don't be barely breathing, just breathe and run.
You got me barely breathing right now. Oh my goodness, the Raji. If there's one thing I love doing is laughing, and I know that it's something that you do a lot of, and I'm glad to be able to laugh with you. I feel like that's I think about that a lot. Like when I laugh with my partner, when I laugh with my friends, I get so, I almost interrupt my enjoyment of the laughter to see how much they're enjoying laughing, because I feel like I almost want to just see them experience it more than I want to laugh on my own, you know?
Yes, and I can relate to that very much. Yes, that's what drew me into comedy when I was young. I liked seeing people buckle over and laugh and lose it to laughter.
What's how young were you? What was like a really young memory of you getting somebody to bust the gut?
The first memory, I think it had to be with my relatives. My aunts and uncles would laugh a lot, and I remember being in social situations with them and laughing. They would be telling stories, and then they'd be telling stories about me doing things I don't remember, and they would just be laughing. And I got the feeling, something about me gets people to laugh. Maybe I just go in and cultivate that. You know? So the first time I think officially got laughter was doing a comedy in a high school play. And I was playing the part of, I think, a beatnik. I was impressed with beatniks at the time. And I found that doing my impression of beatniks could get people to laugh. And though that was high school that I remember. And then I went on to college doing talent shows at Howard University. And that's where I got the inspiration, or the inspiration got me to consider going to New York and exploring semi-professional stand-up comedy. So from my grade school years, well, I think even back before that, before high school, there was I used comedy to disarm the bullies in my neighborhood. I found that, as you noticed, you like seeing people laugh. I like seeing bullies laugh because that means they're less intimidating. And so I developed the skill to intuitively guide someone into their laughter zone. Sometimes it would be just slapstick, sometimes jokes. I got pretty good at remembering and telling jokes that were hilarious. And so that was probably around age of 9 or 10. I know that was the time that we had to be concerned about bullies in the neighborhood. I grew up in a government housing project in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. And there were a few young gentlemen who you had to sort of respect their space when they came around, or they would crash through your boundaries. And so that's when knowing how to get people to laugh, whether a funny face or funny mannerisms. But that was survival and security, the use of comedy to secure your space and to disarm your transgressors. I have one or two more minutes here. I'd like to get an idea of what it looks like when you're on stage. What are you playing, and who else is with you?
When I'm performing, it's always been different. In the past, I made these costumes of people, and I would get volunteers in each city and kind of teach them these moves, and then I would put them in these costumes, and they would dance on stage, and I would give them the trust of being performers, and they would trust me to make sure that they didn't pass out on stage. And there were these wild glittered costumes, and it was a wild time. I met a lot of people like that. A lot of trust was exchanged, and I learned a lot about trust and understanding and caring for folks that I didn't know, but who were willing to participate. But now it's evolved into having musicians on stage, and I have a drummer and a bass guitarist and a guitar player. And so it always evolves, and there's always different people who've participated. But right now I'm on stage singing and playing certain instruments, and play the guitar and a synthesizer at times. But I really, I don't come from a place where I learned an instrument in any kind of formal way. I kind of just taught myself what I know.
Yeah, it comes across pretty good. Also, the way you mic your voice, or the effects on your voice, are quite, I haven't decided how to call it, but it's definitely, there's a character in the way that you present your voice.
Yeah, I've been recording for a long time, since I was a little kid. My dad had this karaoke machine, and it had two cassette decks, and, you know, I must have been like nine. This is like 1988, something like that, and 89. And I thought I invented overdubbing. And because I was just like, you know, I put two and two together, and I was like, oh, you can do this and you can do this, you know? And I really got into recording from that moment on. Then my brother had a computer, and I started making beats, and, you know, I was very into electronic music. And so I've been recording ever since then. And so I think there's like a history of experimentation that is maybe shared or not shared, or that's the history is kind of buried in the work that I do now. And so I've gotten really used to understanding what frequencies I really enjoy living in, but I also I really enjoy process of not having anything be standardized. I kind of mess with whatever I can. And so in the music, I do that a lot. And in performance, I think what I've become more in tune with is like my voice and my body, like how I want to move on stage in a natural way, and how I can sing on stage in a natural way as well. So sometimes it's difficult, but I've found ways to make sure that I'm, like you said, not stepping out of my bliss, where I'm kind of just in there, and I know that I'm there, and that's what I'm doing in that moment.
Such a treat listening into Helado and La Raji's conversation. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of 480 Forages.